Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, I'm Linda Ellerby. I was diagnosed with breast cancer 11 years ago, and I know how scary it can be. Everything your doctor says sounds like a foreign language. HER2-new, oncogene, ductal carcinoma in situ. What do these words mean? How can you decide what to do if you can't even say what you have? Go to breastcancer.org, a special place on the Internet where you can learn how to say those words and find out what they mean. Breastcancer.org, the first place to go the minute you find out you have breast cancer.
Good morning and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I'm your host, Joy Keys. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter.com/Joy Keys, and you can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Also, send me an email. I would love to hear from you. My email address is SaturdaysWithJoyKeys@Hotmail.com. I want to thank you so much. We are past 147,000 downloads of the podcast. Could not have done that without your support. So thank you, thank you, and thank you. Thank you for sharing with your friends and family. I hope the shows have been educational. You've learned something, had some fun, had some laughs at my silliness sometimes. So I just really appreciate your support. This morning I have a wonderful author who didn't actually start out as an author. She was all in TV. She worked on The Cosby Show. She was executive producer of Can't Hurry Love, worked on A Different World. But now she's on her third novel. Her first book, Always Wear Joy, was about her mother, who was an actress, singer, and dancer, Josephine Premis. And her next book that came out in 2010, One Flight Up, talking about some friends in New York dealing with their romance and drama and marriages and so forth. And now her third novel, Imperfect Bliss, dealing with the reality TV shows and trying to find love on TV. Imagine that. It can happen, maybe, I don't know. Good morning, Susan Feltill.
Good morning. I'm so honored to be with you and with your many listeners. So good morning to all.
Well, thank you. This is the second time you've been on. I found, like I said, I was reading some article, and I was like, oh, my gosh, there's another book out. I have to have her come back on. So anybody listening, I do have another interview with Susan, and you can learn about her second novel, One Flight Up, if you listen to that interview. But today we're talking about Imperfect Bliss. Well, I guess you could say marriage these days is almost like imperfect. What, like they say, like 50% of people are getting divorced.
Exactly.
So why should people get married? Susan, tell us, why should people get married?
That's the question everybody's asking. It's the title of a Tyler Perry film. Why did I get married?
Right.
I think too, right?
It
is very much an institution that's under siege. And one that people are trying to figure out. I still think there's a tremendous value to it, and this book is not an indictment of marriage. The main character is divorced, and she had married the love of her life. And he ended up, they had a child who had some disabilities, and that's when the marriage started to fall apart, as often will happen. Children unite you and divide you, as most people with children. By definition, imperfect bliss is marriage with children. You know, because all those cute, well, those, all those things that are really adorable to you about your mate that are different, and when you have children, it suddenly becomes the battleground. You know, it didn't bother you before that he's Episcopalian and you're a Baptist, but all of a sudden it's like, no, you're not taking my child to that church, you know. It didn't bother you before that they had a different political point of view, but suddenly you're like, oh, my God, you're
it didn't bother
these ideas to our child.
That they were maybe a spender and you're a saver.
Exactly.
I mean,
it's like it was all
–
exactly. It was very cute before a child came along, and then suddenly it's like, you're wasting $5. Our child is going to be in a trailer park, you know.
Right. It's funny. One of my doctors – I won't mention his name, but one of my doctors didn't want to have kids, but he negotiated – and these were his words. He's telling me this – with his current wife to have one child. Mm-hmm. Well, unfortunately, he got cursed. She had twins. And then within a year or later, they had another child. So now he has three kids.
Well, and that story, so meshes with kind of my point of view in all my books. First of all, the notion of negotiating, because marriage is a contract. We layer all this romance on it, but it is a contract between two people. The second part of that story that I love is I have that personality. You want to control everything. You have a little plan. Well, you know, man plans and God laughs, as the expression goes.
Yes.
And that's what happened
to
my character.
He was laughing. He was laughing.
God was laughing and saying, really? One child? Okay.
One child. Let's talk about why you got into writing novels. Because you have this long history of TV for many years.
Yes.
Very successful career. Wasn't like it was, you know, doing bad or anything. But what turned you to writing novels?
So my first book was actually a memoir about my mother. And I had an epiphany. I was having a meeting with Whoopi Goldberg and some major network executives over a pilot script that we had done. And the subject was a black Broadway diva who had fallen on hard times and had to turn to a career in decorating because she couldn't get a job as an actress. And she would transform people's lives, sort of Auntie Mame / Mary Poppins style. And we, you know, my mother was one of the great divas, Josephine Premice. You can see her on vintageblackglamour.com if you go. There's an image of her in there right now. And I grew up around, obviously, her and Diane Carroll and Eartha Kitt and Lena Horne and all these remarkable women who really transformed the image of African-American women, not only in this country but also internationally. So there we are in this note session with these executives, and they started to give us notes on what a diva is. And I was like having an out-of-body experience. It was like, have I died and gone to hell, and this is my punishment for all eternity to listen to these people tell me what a diva is? You know,
I will rewrite
something from A to Z. There are a lot of areas in which I'm ignorant, but I have a PhD in divology. So, you know, I nobody can tell me what a diva is. I was breastfed by them. So I sat in that room and thought, the revolution will not be televised. They do not even have a frame of reference for who these women are that we're talking about. They've never seen any of them perform. They don't know any of them. They were citing examples of all of these Caucasian actresses who are very talented but in a whole different vein. And so that in that moment, it was 1998, I thought to myself, you're going to have to tell your mother's story in a different way. So cut to 2 years later, my mother was dying, and I had the chance, because I wrote an article in Vogue that was very well received, I had the opportunity to write a memoir about her. And that's when I first started to turn to writing. My mother passed away in the middle of my process of writing this book. And at the memorial service, I showed footage of her from the Merv Griffin show back in the 60s, and she sang this song in Italian. And Tim Reed, who's a very close friend, he's like my older brother, you know, creator of Frank's Place and brilliant actor, director, everything. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Tim took me aside and he said, you know, it's so fascinating that your mother would have made the choice to sing in Italian on that show. Most people would have taken an American standard, you know, to be acceptable and popular. But your mother took this very brave route of singing in a language nobody spoke, and here's this jet black woman, 1966 it was, and he said she really followed her own path. And that really struck me, and it was another moment of epiphany of saying, guess what, you know, life is short, and rather than trying to please the public or please the powers that be in television, sing your song. And I realized, and I was coming up with ideas of things to pitch to TV, and my husband said, you know, other than the money, what keeps you in it right now? And I sort of stared at him blankly.
Wow. So that was definitely a good question of him. Yeah.
That's a really good question and a very kind and generous question to ask. And so because it was the old economy and because I had been careful with my money and because he was, you know, earning a nice living, I thought, you know what, get off this treadmill and go and do something else for a while. And what books have given me the freedom to do is to write about the worlds that I know, that television isn't always receptive to and the movies aren't always receptive to. You can write about a range of ages. I mean, I don't know if you're noticing, but there aren't too many women over 30 in interesting parts in the movies.
And if they are, they have like they're like caricatures.
They're
exactly. With like Botox and plastic surgery
exactly.
And lips.
Exactly.
I got a butt implant and I got a rib taken out.
Exactly.
I bleached my skin. Because maybe I'm too dark.
Exactly.
All kinds of things. The lighting is not right, especially for women of color, whether you're Asian, African American.
Exactly.
So
and
very hard.
We don't see the range. We don't see the rainbow. And we don't see the different ages. I mean, I was on a plane and they were showing this French film starring Catherine Deneuve, who's nearly 70
mm-hmm.
years old. And she was the romantic heroine of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And she's not the size she was when she first started. She's still gorgeous, but gorgeous of her age. And I thought, this just doesn't happen in America. We don't see that. So in books, however, you can have a range of ages. And in my book, the women's ages range from age 4 to age 65. And this is a book about a woman who's divorced, 33 and a half, with her young disabled child who finds love for the second time. So
let me read a little bit. Let me just give the audience a little taste.
A little
here.
Taste? Okay.
A little taste. This is one of the steamy themes, so you guys might want to get a cold glass of water to drink after I read this. But here it goes. Just take a deep breath, okay? All right. This is from Susan Salthill's book, Imperfect Bliss. As Jordan unlocked the front door of his classic brick Georgetown townhouse, Bliss cast nervous glances onto the street. She felt a warm, large hand fall on her right palm and pull her firmly inside. Jordan pushed her against the door, and his full mouth met hers. He parted his lips gently and waited for hers to yield. Then it began. The deeper his tongue penetrated, the more her body relaxed and melded with his strong 6'5" athletic frame. He began to remove her sweatpants, sliding them slowly over her hips. Okay, I'm not going to read anymore because I'm getting a little hot. But that's just a little taste there.
But it's
to
also
the audience.
We have to say to the audience that there's also an intellectual side. One of my friends said,
yes.
I don't
yes.
feel guilty reading your books because I actually learned stuff. There's a big focus in this book on this
historical figure.
Yes.
A chivalrous historical figure that ends up getting highlighted. But why don't you talk to the audience about the guy? Go
this
ahead.
Is a fascinating figure from French history, and he was brought to my attention by the actor George Stanford Brown. He was called the Black Mozart, and his name was the Chevalier de Saint-Georges. And he was the mulatto son of a white planter and his African slave, Nenon. But unlike what would happen to such a man here, i.e. Thomas Jefferson's sons, he was completely acknowledged by his father. He carried the family name. He carried the noble title. And his father, when he was a little boy, brought him and his mother to Paris, and also his wife. Everyone was on the boat together. I don't know how the women felt, but whatever. But he brought him to Paris, and he set him up in a proper home, and he hired the greatest violin teachers, the greatest fencing masters, and he became this violin prodigy, a great composer whose compositions were heard by the very young Mozart, a very famous symphonic orchestra leader, and one of the greatest fencers in all of Europe. He was a phenomenon. And he was very famous throughout Europe in the 18th century. So I've always been fascinated by this character. And originally I was going to turn this into kind of a time travel romance of a woman from the 21st century who's fascinated.
Yeah.
And then I thought, that's kind of necrophilia. This is getting weird. And my agent, I could just hear my agent going, what? A woman's going to travel back to the 18th century to get it on with a guy with a powdered wig.
Reeve. Do you remember that movie? Christopher Reeve was in the movie.
Exactly, exactly.
Somewhere
in time.
Fell in love with the picture. Somewhere in time.
Yeah,
so,
somewhere in time.
It's not unheard of.
It's not unheard of.
Let me ask you, though. Did your mom talk to you about the birds and bees? Because that's a big issue in the book, skirting around, not wanting to talk about sexuality, not wanting to talk about sensuality, which are different, Did your mom have a conversation with you or your father?
Absolutely, she did. My mother did. My father didn't handle that kind of thing. He was on the let's talk about literature and history side and mathematics. My mother absolutely did. My mother was very frank about sexuality. And she actually used to say to me, if you are a virgin when you're getting married, I will object at the wedding. I do not want you to be a virgin because
wow.
you need to have had experiences. I mean, she didn't want
okay.
me to go out and be a hoe, but
no.
she felt that I... She wasn't saying, take your panties off, but
no.
she believed that women should be fully realized and that they
okay.
should understand their bodies, and she wanted me to have had romances and experiences before picking the ultimate person, and she was she explained sex to me when I was 9, and when I was 15 and I was starting to really develop and have a body, she would dress me in kind of not provocative outfits, but she'd pick things that weren't little girlish.
Wow.
She said, look,
okay.
you're a woman and you have a beautiful body, and I want you to, she wanted me to embrace my body and embrace
right, and not be
my sensuality and not be ashamed. And mm-hmm. Again, nothing was tawdry and tacky. My mother had exquisite taste, but it was, sensuality is a beautiful thing and not mm-hmm. not something to be ashamed of. I mean, there's some statistic in
there's
this.
There's such a fine line, though, Susan, because nowadays these young girls, they, first of all, the clothes just don't fit. Can I just say that to you?
No, can we
there?
Just say, you know, just because you can squeeze into it doesn't mean you should have it
on. Exactly, exactly. And some of the young women, like, you know, say a girl who's age 15, beautiful young women, great bodies, but the clothes you're wearing make you look horrendous. They actually don't make you look better. Your
mm-hmm.
pants, I don't want to see the crack in your butt. I don't need to see, you know,
no,
your
exactly.
unshaven underarms. I don't
exactly.
need to see half your regular hair and then half this weave, and you're brushing the weave like it's gold, and then half your hair is, you know, matted and kinky. Like, okay, wear the kinky hair out and be happy about that, or wear this, but you got to do it right. You know, there's a fine line, and I think a lot of parents, I hate to say this, I'm a parent, you're a parent, have gotten lazy, though, about the guidelines they've set.
Oh, no, but my mother had such strict guidelines. I was not
right,
allowed to wear heels till a certain
classy.
Age. I wasn't
right.
allowed to wear makeup till a certain age.
And that's exactly,
anything
yeah.
too provocative was nixed immediately.
Mm-hmm.
She had very strict rules about, you know, you don't chew gum. You
oh
don't
my God!
Wear.
You had the gum and the. You have a whole scene about the gum and how the grandmother is getting like having a heart attack because of chewing gum. One of the other scenes I love is about Barbies and Bliss, who's the main character, wouldn't let her daughter have Barbies. My mom would not let me have Barbies.
Yep.
I did not have a Barbie in our house.
Barbies are based on a porn star. There was a German porn star who was the model for the original Barbie. So, you know, the provenance is not elegant.
Yeah, well, first of all, her measurements are completely unrealistic.
Exactly.
Nobody can be a Barbie.
Exactly.
But I totally, when you had that scene, I was like, oh, my God, I know how you feel, Bella. I couldn't have one either, you know. But I did, as I got older, she let me have other dolls. And now the funny thing is when my daughter, I have a daughter, she's now about to go to college, but I did let her have Barbie. But the funny thing is, she ended up cutting Barbie's hair all off because at the time my hair was short. So and she did other things with Barbie. So it's like, I think it's a balance.
I completely agree.
You know?
It is about a balance. I think Bliss, the mother in this case, goes too far. She's a little too paranoid. You know, a Barbie is not going to transform your child into an idiot. So, but back to your whole question of the balance, that's one of the themes of the book, is that we have lost the sense of sensuality. When I write "quote unquote" sex scenes, it's never actual sex. It's sensuality, which is a beautiful thing that must be celebrated. There's a big opposition in the book between real virtue and false virtue. Bliss's baby sister, because she's a doctor certified virgin, is chosen to be the star of a show called The Virgin. But her sister is actually, though she's physically a virgin, she is very calculating. She's somebody who's essentially selling herself as a commodity, which to me is the opposite of virtue. And Bliss, who was very much in love with her husband, and we discover in the book only has ever had one lover, is the truly virtuous person in spite of her enormous sexual appetite, because she seeks real spiritual connection with other people. And so that's one of the points I want to make. It's not a morally judgmental book, but I think that there's, when you listen to very young women.
Well, each of the characters have a battle.
Exactly.
Each of the characters are having a battle. You know, the husband is having a battle trying to, he loves his wife, the father or grandfather, you say, of Bella and the father of Bliss. He's having a battle to allow his wife to do her thing, but at the same time not embarrass the family. The mother figure for Cynthia is, you know, way all the way to the edge. But, you know, you also bring up her dealing with racial issues because she's married to, it's a interracial marriage.
Yeah, yeah.
And you bring up issues that she has to deal with, colonial education that totally twisted her mind about what her beauty was and her culture.
Yep.
And not accepting and wanting to, like, aim to be this, like, over-Brit, this, like, you know.
More British than the British. Yeah, the mother
is... Right, more British than the British, you know.
The mother is a Jamaican who grew up very poor, and she's dark under colonialism. And obviously not every Jamaican who was raised that way turned out this way, but this woman has developed a degree of self-loathing and is of the mentality, which there are people who feel this way, that you improve yourself by marrying a white person and you aim to have children who are lighter than you are. So I wanted to explore that and the damage that's done to certain people. Bliss, the main character, is somebody who has tremendous pride in being African-American, and yet she could pass for white, but she has absolutely no interest in doing that. It was interesting because I got a comment from one reviewer who loved the book but said they wished that I'd explored more what it was to be a fair-skinned black person, a black person who could pass, and I thought that really isn't the point of this book.
That's a different book.
There was actually a wonderful book called Caucasia, written by a woman who is in that situation. And I was more just, to me, it's an element of her character, but I wanted to portray a biracial woman who could pass but was so comfortable in her own skin as a black woman that she just didn't even deal with that. It was incidental, and she has a fierce passion.
Well, I mean, people are more than their skin color. I don't wake up every morning. I don't walk out my door and say, I'm a black woman, you know.
Thank you, Joy. Thank you.
Yeah, you
thank
don't.
You. You don't do that.
Mind.
Exactly.
And
when you're in a mixed family, you don't walk around all day going, as we know, we are mixed. Because we're just like, this is mom and this is dad, you know, and it's just your reality. So,
well, have you watched any of these, talking about reality, these reality shows? We got like The Millionaire Matchmaker, we got Tough Love.
In fact,
Bachelor, you know.
Well, of course, we all started by watching The Bachelor, and one of the things that I wanted to explore in this book is the ways in which these shows are distorting marriage. I mean, between The Millionaire Matchmaker, and there was one show about, it was short-lived, but about trying to marry a prince, we're reinstilling this sort of fairy tale of, well, just nab a rich guy and live happily ever after.
And, you know, the funny thing is, if it's a bachelorette, then the guys are either wealthy and they have their own business, or they're like actors and like physical trainers.
Exactly.
And if it's a bachelor, the girls may or may not be rich, but usually they're like actresses, secretaries. I mean, nothing against anybody in these positions, but it's just so stereotypical because they have to take like 2 months off or 3 months off of a job. So it's a certain type of person that goes on that show, and they only have 2 months, I think it is, like on The Bachelor, to get to know the person, and then you're supposed to marry them?
Yeah, and then you're
going to
decide you're going to marry them. And meanwhile, half of it is on camera. Half the time, you're in a hot tub with 10 other people. You know,
you're like living a five-star life. You may not even ever live that five-star life. So it's not reality. And a lot of those relationships, you know, Susan, you see them, they don't last.
Yeah.
They usually end up breaking up.
Exactly.
So it's crazy. But I love the book, Imperfect Bliss. I'll be giving away some copies of the book, so I want to encourage people to follow me at Joy Keys on Twitter and become a fan on Facebook. Look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. Also, check out Susan's website, which is her name, SusanFails-Hill.com, and you can also follow her on Twitter, Susan Fails Hill. on Twitter to learn more about her and see where she's going to be. Now, where are you going to be doing a reading next?
So excited because I'm going to be doing a reading at the Pratt Library in Maryland on Tuesday, the 17th, at 6:30 p.m. in the Poe Room, the Edgar Allan Poe Room. And that's a fantastic, fantastic library. And Carla Hayden, its president, has been phenomenally supportive of my work. So I'm very excited. So for anyone who's in the Baltimore area, please come to the Poe Room at the Pratt Library.
And that's, you said July 17th, right?
July 17th, exactly.
Okay.
So,
and then where are you going to be at? One other place you're going to be after that, where are you going to be?
No, I have nothing so far.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, go to her website and follow her on Twitter, SusanFails-Hill.com, and then also follow her on Twitter, SusanFailsHill. Follow me because she's going to be autographing a copy of the book to give to you, so you want to follow at Joy Keys and become a fan on Facebook. Look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keys. I hope that you all who are listening find your bliss, whether within yourself or in partnership with another person. And Susan, thank you so much for coming on again.
Joy, thank you for having me. Thank you for finding the book. And I hope everybody enjoys this beach read with a brain.
I'll talk to you soon. Have a wonderful Saturday.
God bless you. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, bye. Bye-bye. Thank you, everybody, for listening. I just got off the phone with author extraordinaire Susan Fails Hill about her book, Imperfect Bliss. Lots of twists and turns and not what you think. It's not just all sex. Trust me, majority of it isn't. And actually, the sex scenes are actually daydreams, not actual sex scenes. So there's a lot of intelligentsia attraction in there in terms of her historical references that she makes to actual people who live. So check out Imperfect Bliss. Follow me at Joy Keys on Twitter. Become a fan on Facebook. Have a wonderful Saturday. But if you want, stay tuned. I'll be speaking with Rachel Swarn about her book, American Tapestry. She goes into the history, the ancestry of Michelle Obama. So that should be a good one. Stay tuned. That's at 11:30. Have a wonderful Saturday.